Yes, thank you. Beautiful. Morning, everybody. As you know, we've been in our series of great questions, and so here's what I got for you today. I want to talk about, do we need the masculine and feminine anymore? And you might want to ask something like, what do you mean by masculine and feminine? And now we're in the right kind of terrain, and it's kind of uncomfortable terrain. It's the kind of terrain that one could get canceled from any side, you know, the moment we begin to wade into these waters. And so that seems like just the right kind of thing to do here at C3. So, yeah, thanks for joining. And I want to actually start off with a poem. I want to start in kind of an unusual place. And I want to start with a poem about childhood, because it's really challenging to talk about masculine and feminine without talking about childhood, without just keeping that in mind. And actually, I just want the poem and the imagery to sit way back there as we sort of explore the terrain. And, you know, you use your imagination and try to enter this poem. This is an Anne Sexton poem here. They sit in a row outside the kindergarten, black, red, brown, all with those brass buckles. Remember when you couldn't buckle your own overshoe? Or tie your own overshoe? Or tie your own shoe? Or cut your own meat, and the tears running down like mud because you fell off your tricycle? Remember, big fish, when you couldn't swim and simply slipped under like a stone frog. The world wasn't yours. It belonged to the big people. Under your bed sat the wolf, and he made a shadow when cars passed by at night. They made you give up your nightlight and your teddy and your thumb. Oh, overshoes, don't you remember me? Pushing you up and down in the winter snow. Oh, thumb, I want a drink. It is dark. Where are the big people? When will I get there? Taking giant steps all day, each day, and thinking nothing of it. You know, where'd that child go? And one sense I have is that the psyche is kind of mysterious, and that child is in your very being as we're sitting here. And you carry that child with you, even though you now know how to tie your shoes, or for the most part, or buy shoes where you don't have to bend over and tie them anymore. Yeah, and here's an analogy. I got this image from James Finley, and it's an image really that's associated with trauma, and it's important to bring up if we're going to wade into masculine and feminine issues today. And so here's the image. It goes something like this. Let's say that your childhood house is on fire. All right, your childhood house is on fire, and you're living there. And meanwhile, the big people in your childhood house are just carrying on their business. And inside, you're feeling, though you might not have language, like, this house is on fire. And let's say this traumatic environment that you grew up in, you make it out one day. And how do you know you make it out? You're like, oh my God, I made it out. That's how you know. And you're standing there in the lawn, and you look back, and your house is there on fire, and you look up in the window, and you see a little boy or a little girl, and you realize, that's me, still in there. And James Finley says that trauma work, or facing traumatic or wounding dynamics, is often like going back into the burning building and taking that kid by the hand. Because you can't leave him behind. And there's something about this poem, too, that's kind of like that. It's like, where'd that kid go? Now, that's the poetic backdrop for what I want to say, because it's going to feel like now I'm just going to abandon ship and not talk about that. I just want you to carry that childhood image with you as we explore these really sensitive terrains. Your own innocence, and the innocence of just of being itself and being a human being, that wild, precious innocence of just your humanness coming into the world, and the humanness of everyone. Can't you sometimes look at someone and see a child? I can. Like, all of a sudden, something of their own wild innocence comes through, and you're like, there it is. So just kind of let that be in the background as we kind of wade into these sort of tricky waters. Now, I just came off a retreat, an intensive, that's what I like to call them, the one that I led here in Michigan, and it was called Exploring the Sacred Masculine. So you might already have some idea of where I'm going. Do we need the masculine and the feminine anymore? I just did a retreat last weekend called Exploring the Sacred Masculine. And but I want to admit something about why I was doing a program like this. First of all, I'm surprised I'm doing a program like this. This is not something I have always been into, like men's work. Like if you would have asked me 10 years ago, hey, do you want to get into men's work? I'd be like, no thanks. Was that like, you know, playing paintball in the woods or something like that? And so I've been kind of reluctant. And there was, you know, maybe 15, 20 years ago in evangelical circles, there was this book floating around that had to do with masculinity. And I read it, and I had all kinds of objections to it. And, you know, this is, I'm not going to name the book, but I was like, this is ridiculous. This guy's full of crap, which now that I know something about the psyche, might tell me something like, there must have been some material in here I didn't want to look at. I don't know. So, yeah, I've just been reluctant. And, of course, there are a whole plethora of exaggerations around masculinity. And our culture either totally rejects things or clings to caricatures that seem unhealthy and immature. So I just thought it best to avoid the topic altogether. Plus, I was a literature major, and I read Virginia Woolf, you know. Doesn't that make me a feminist? So I've been reluctant, but I found my way into it kind of slowly. I read a book called Iron John. It's a Robert Bly book many years ago, and I read it on the plane to Alaska, of all places. Sounds very manly, I guess. But I remember reading it, and every once in a while I would close the book while I was on the plane and put it down, and I would feel and think, what the hell is this? Who writes like this, first of all? But what is this terrain? What is being explored here? It's a book about the myth Iron John, which is older than Christianity, really. And Robert Bly sort of just riffs on it for 238 pages. I don't really know if that's how long the book is, but something like that. And that was the beginning of sort of entering some terrain that I was a little uncomfortable with and probably needed to look at. And last year I did an online class based on the book, and that was the first time it was sort of like an all-men thing. I didn't even set it up that way. I just said, I'm going to do an online class on Iron John, and guess who signed up? Only men. So that sort of paved the way to thinking about doing a retreat and a program on the sacred masculine. So I'm just admitting I've kind of come into it in a slow and roundabout way here. And what would I say about it now? I'm saying that we have a problem. I think we have a problem. We have a problem around really a crisis around masculinity, or to put more simply, being a man, or even more simply, how to grow up. We have a crisis around that. And in turn, that means we also have a crisis around the feminine. We don't know what we mean by these things. We don't know to what we're being called to live into. We don't know even our own potentialities. We have a lot of information about how things go wrong. And I'm sure if I ask you right now to make a list of men that you think are doing damage to themselves in the world, that would be easy. Well, what about a list of men who are causing, how would I even put it? What would be the opposite of that? See, I even have a hard time saying what the opposite of that would be. Generative, sacrificial, empathetic, whatever, fill in the blank. You might have a hard time with that list. Might have a hard time with that list. So, okay, let me say something about the age that we're in, because that's just sort of a little bit of my background, how I got into this kind of stuff. So what I would say there's some confusion around the masculine and feminine. Eventually I'll try to define what I mean by these things, but not right this second. And a lot of blame, that's the age that we live in, a lot of blame on the masculine or the patriarchy. That's always fun. Just blame the patriarchy. Well, what do we mean by that? You want to ask, what exactly is that? Or is it just now a blanket term for things we don't like? Or men in general? What's it like actually to grow up as a young person or a young man feeling and believing that somehow you're the problem with society and culture and civilization and history? Because that's how it can feel in its most exaggerated form. Is that good for young people? That's my question. We're also in an age where, you know, gender roles are being challenged. Gender itself, in a way, is being challenged. And here's where, you know, maybe the right and the left both have these, like, exaggerated forms here. And sort of the right says, there's nothing to see here. There's nothing to see here. No questions can be asked. End of story. It's always been this way. And the left has its own exaggerated version of that, which is something like, well, everything is a social construct. Everything is a social construct. Words are social constructs. It is, I can infuse it with whatever kind of meaning I want. And on the one hand, that can feel like freedom. On the other hand, it's pretty hard to say sort of definitively that everything is a social construct, because that phrase then is a social construct. So it kind of like collapses in on itself, and it leaves confusion. I think the polls are leaving us in confusion, but they're both examples of something that needs to be looked at. That's what I'm trying to get at. We need to look at these things. You say, what do we mean by these things? And maybe just a little bit more on language. I just pick on language for a moment. So I went to college in the 90s, and 90s was the best era, of course, as you know. And the, you know, the big popular word was, you know, postmodernism. That's what we were all talking about in college, even though I had no idea what I was talking about, but I was sounding authoritative talking about postmodernism. And I went to college at Liberty in Lynchburg, Virginia, where I grew up. And just 45 minutes north is UVA, University of Virginia, and who always destroyed us in soccer every year. It was terrible. My dad went to UVA, did his PhD there, and at the time there was a professor named Richard Rorty there, and he is sort of carrying on the legacy of like Derrida and these other postmodern thinkers, and famously he had left the philosophy department saying philosophy is dead and all that's left is linguistic social constructs. So he became an English major, which made me excited because that's what I was. And anyway, my friends, I never went on the, because I really wasn't much of a philosopher, but they would go up and hear him speak every once in a while. And what was really coming into fashion in the 50s, 60s, and then in its later form in the 90s, that everything is a social construct, has now sort of made its way, infused its way into the way we speak about things. Truth is a matter of personal opinion. We would say, your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth. Except we also feel that that causes problems, because don't you bump into other people's truths that you think are not truths? Yeah, so it's hard. And some of the gifts of sort of postmodern critique, which is true, especially as it relates to masculine and feminine, is that there is some truth to social construction and how language can morph and change and move, and it's not so fixed. For example, if you said the statement, which would be a true statement, Kent Dobson is cool, okay? Language is slippery because depending on your perspective or even era or time period, that can mean something like Kent Dobson is awesome, like just really, he's a really cool guy. Or it could mean that he's emotionally shut down. Or it could mean that he's like physically cold, you know? So it's true that language is slippery and there's a dimension that is a social construct, but it's also sort of kind of a scary world to live in if we put everything in that category, that it's just a matter of linguistic social power games that are fictions. So it gives us trouble. It gives us trouble when we come to masculine, feminine, and all of the other questions that arise. So that's kind of the background here. All right, here's my goal. I want to talk about what is an archetype, and then I want to talk about an image of wholeness. That's the terrain. That was just the introduction. So I want to begin by having a conversation about archetypes, because I think if we're going to have an intelligent and nuanced conversation about masculine and feminine, we need to know what an archetype is. An archetype is simply a pattern. That's the simplest way of putting it. It's a pattern that shows up again and again and again and again. It might not always show up exactly the same, But over time, you recognize it as a pattern. You say, oh, it's something like this. And already you can feel, when you think about the question of, well, I'll just put it forth as a statement, masculine and feminine have archetypal qualities, you would want to say something like, over time, does the pattern show up in a certain way? Actually, archetype, here's an image, it actually comes from Latin, but you know the image, maybe I told you this before, but it's worth repeating. You know how they made coins in the ancient world? They maybe still make them this way, I don't know. But in the ancient world, you had a mold of some sort, usually made of stone, and you'd pour hot metal in there, and then you would stamp that, and it would sort of complete the mold. And, you know, I collect ancient coins, and they kind of leak out, and that's what makes them sort of interesting. But that's actually what the image is rooted in, an archetype. An archetype is the mold itself. It's not the image that gets printed. It's the mold. It's that constellating energetic force that wants to bring something together. The actual image on the coin might look different in different places. For example, if you want to said, hey, give us an image of a king. Well, depending on where you lived in the world, that image would look slightly different. Wouldn't you agree? But the question behind that is, what's that constellating force that wants to bring that forth in the first place? And that's what an archetype is. Another way of saying it is an archetype is a series of potentialities. Like, if you think about masculine, what potentials are present? If you think about feminine, what potentials are present, stretched out over vast stretches of time? That's an archetype. I might want to give you some examples to make it more concrete. How many of you had a mother or father? Okay. How many had both, really? Okay. Even if you didn't know them, you had them. And growing up, come back to that childhood image, kindergarten, no matter what, you were exposed not only to mother, father, but to the archetype of mother and father stretched out over vast stretches of time. How would you know if you had a good mother or a bad mother or a good father or a bad father? It's not like when you're five, your parents sat you down and say, I want you to know now I'm a bad parent. And there are good parents out there. It's in the psyche, that's more of a Jungian perspective, but it's also in the world, stretched out over time. And you come to know who you are in relation to the pattern itself. And you can extend those all the way into nature itself, you know. The great mother, for example. Your mother will never be that good of a mother because she's being compared to the archetype of the great mother. Have I made sense? And the great mother is extremely powerful. The energetic constellation of the archetype is extremely powerful, and it influences us, and it influences how we see the world. That's an archetype. So that's what I'd like to suggest, that masculine and feminine are archetypes in that way. They're constellating energies of power that are extremely influential on the psyche and on the world and how we see things and how we come to know things. Now, they have a shadow. I'll get to this in a second. They have a shadowy side to them, too. I'll just hold off on that thought. Okay, so here's point number one coming out of the archetype here. We are carrying and are influenced by these great archetypal patterns. That's the first statement I want to make. You're influenced by them, whether you like it or not. Here are examples. How many of you have ever seen The Lion King? Anybody seen The Lion King? You know. You know that scene where, I don't remember all the characters' name, but I think Simba is the lion, right? They hold Simba up as a little infant, all right? Now, I think you have to be pretty cold to not be moved by that scene. Like, you might want to even push down tears, or you just might want to cry outright. Why? Because that's an archetype. It's like there's something so powerful about life and the possibility coming forth into the world that we're moved in some way. All of Disney is a billion-dollar industry because all they do is play with archetypes. That's all they do. They play with archetypes, and that's why they'll always be in business. You'll never. Sometimes they're not all the great archetypes, but they still play with them, and that's what makes them so powerful. You know. So we're carrying and are influenced by patterns like this. I said this a couple weeks ago, but like the most, you know, influential books on the planet besides the Bible are like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings. Why? They're playing with archetypes. That's all. And like, think about Harry Potter. Think how richly archetypal it is. You have kings and queens and magicians and hags and warriors and huntresses and on and on and on and on it goes. And something in us wakes up because those are potentialities in the human spirit. Have I made sense? They're also playing with masculine and feminine patterns here. Okay, so what's my point? One of my points is that masculine and feminine are sacred archetypes and they should be treated like gods. It doesn't mean that there are not problems, particularly with the masculine or with the feminine. But I would like to suggest one of the problems we're having is that we're not treating them as sacred potentialities and powers. We're diminishing them in some way. We're flattening the world out. There's nothing, it's all should be pushed down to a kind of level, flatness. Is that working very well? Is that the right kind of impulse? It's a question I have. Here's point number two. Archetypes have mature and immature expression. Okay, for example. So this comes from a book called, if you want to know, it's called King, Warrior, Magician, Prophet. It has two authors. Can't remember the name of it. It's a Jungian book. It's a pretty easy read, interesting read. But they talk about the king archetype. And let me say something positive about the king archetype right now. How many of you are aware that there's an election coming? Anyone? Now, I'll just read to you, just from a psychological point of view, why you might get fired up about an election. It's because of the influence of the king and the queen archetype. That's why. Because you look at leadership and you think, it should not be this way. Now, where did that come from? I'm saying it came from somewhere deeper than just your socialization. Books you've read, ideas that you think you hold. It's actually much deeper. Like, it feels very dark to the human spirit to have a leader of some sort, or a king or a queen, that's the archetype, that is not benevolent and doesn't have the interest of the populace in mind. That's a very dark place. And that motivates you, correct? Now, you're not going to go, to your friends and say, go to the polls because of the king and queen archetype. You know, they'll be like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. But that's partly what's happening, at least in my view. Because it's a constellated image over time. It has power. Okay, here's what comes from that book. They said the king archetype has an underdeveloped shadow side, and that underdeveloped shadow side has a bipolar nature, and that's the tyrant or the weakling. Okay? So if you just take masculine archetype, which king is, you can apply the same to queen, by the way, but I'll just hold off on that. The underdeveloped, immature expression of the potentialities of being a good king comes out as a tyrant or a weakling. Do you see a lot of tyrants? Do you see a lot of weaklings? Well, partly that's because we don't have a lot of conversation with the mature side of the potentiality there. We just have these two options. And then we have whole cultures that collect around the two options. You got to be a tyrant if you want to get anything done, or you have to be so passive that you have no sense of agency. Do you feel how you, and even one person can pass between these two poles. Ask any man in your life if they've ever passed between the poles of tyrant and weakling, and if they have any degree of honesty, they'll say, yeah, every week, something like that. Okay? All right, so it has a shadow side. Let me pick on the Great Mother, for example. The Great Mother is the deep image of nurturing that is in nature itself. Wouldn't you agree? Does it have a shadow side? Well, Freud called it the devouring mother. Okay? It just will eat up everything, including the potentiality of her own children in the largest sense. That's a helicopter parent, really. That's like, hey, what are you kids playing? I can play dolls too. You know, where are you guys going? Just following, hovering, hovering, devouring, devouring, devouring. Too nurturing. That's why Freud said one of his darkest lines, the good mother necessarily fails. So you fail at the task of nurturing if there's going to be some kicking out of the nest in some way. Anyway, my point is the great mother can devour everything. You know, have you ever seen that picture of Kali holding the skulls of men? That's always a fun image. We're all into the divine feminine. Have you seen that image? You know, just, you don't think that that's real? Okay. Okay, so what's my point here? Point number two. Here's a question that we must ask. How do we grow into more mature possibilities of these archetypes, like king or queen or magician or crone or hag or warrior or huntress? That's the traditional forms. You might give them slightly different names, but I'm saying, how do we grow into our own potentialities as human beings? Because I'm saying, my argument would be, you can't without a conversation with the archetypes. There are two famous stories. I could like do two talks on these. Maybe I mentioned them before, but this will be the drive-through version. Just two myths for fun. The first myth is the myth of the Fisher King. And here's the Fisher King myth in a nutshell. Parsifal is on a big journey. He's about to grow up, and he leaves home. He's got a couple problems because his mom says, don't ask any questions and wear this special underwear that I made you. Okay, that's the devouring mother. And so he sets off in the world wearing his mother's underwear. And the first thing he meets, actually, is the wounded king, the Fisher King. And he's got a wound. And it's a festering wound. It won't go away. And it's extremely painful. And it's located in his thigh. Okay? And the only relief he ever gets is fishing. You wonder why some men like fishing. Because it's just, that's a literal version of the myth. Some relief from this wound. And Parsifal takes his mother's advice and doesn't ask any questions when he meets the Fisher King and goes into the Fisher King's house and sees the Grail. It's funny because, you know, if you've heard about the quest for the Grail, in the Parsifal story, he finds the Grail right away. Right away, there it is. But he forgets to ask questions about it. And he doesn't know the ultimate question, which is, whom does the Grail serve? That's the ultimate question. But he doesn't know how to ask that question yet. So the Fisher King's wound is going to continue to fester until he learns to ask the question of service. So what's that telling you? The masculine, as an archetype, is wounded. And it's not going to grow into a very healthy king unless it deals with its wound. And that wound has something to do with a sacrificial orientation in the world. You can't be a king unless you sacrifice. That's what the story is saying. I'm telling you, that's a very powerful myth. And in terms of the great stories of humanity, it just came out. All right, meaning it just appeared on Netflix, in other words. It's not that old, really, and we haven't dealt with it very much. Here's a feminine version of the same archetypal story, and that's the Handless Maiden. So the Handless Maiden begins with the miller, and millers were always like a little bit tricky in mythology because they had this technology that they could take advantage of people. So it was like kind of their trickstery kind of figures. Anyway, the miller makes a deal with the devil one day. The devil comes and says, hey, I'm going to teach you some form of technology here, and you'll be able to, you know, produce more grain. But I want something in exchange. And he says, what do you want in exchange? He's like, I want what's behind your house. And the miller thinks, oh, I know what's behind the house. It's my apple tree. He just wants my apples. No problem. Says, done. And so they go behind the house, and who's standing there but the miller's daughter? Okay? So it's a terrible thing. The miller's all in grief. He doesn't want to give his daughter up to the devil, so he cuts off her hands. Okay? Myths are, you know, they give you a little chills, all right? Cuts off her hands, and then the devil doesn't want her anymore, and so she's cast out and has to wander. She wanders and wanders. By the way, a little interpretation. What does patriarchal masculine society tend to do to young women? Okay, you know now. The story is, you know, 1,000 years old. Cuts off her hands. And so anyway, she wanders, and eventually she meets a benevolent, like, prince-like figure, and they get married. And the prince makes for her silver hands. And they're very beautiful. Like, imagine if you had silver hands, how beautiful that would be. And she's able to have a family and is able to contribute again to society, except there's a problem. What's the problem? They're not her hands. All right? And so it's just describing a little bit of the feminine journey here. Your hands can be cut off, and society then gives you the appropriate thing that you should be, but it's not that real, right? Does that resonate at all? And then she wanders a little more, and eventually her own child falls into a pond and is about to drown, and she reaches instinctually for the child, and her hands grow back. So it's about the return of instinct after being cut off by something. Now, is that story important right now? It just came out, just appeared on Netflix. It's that relevant, okay? It's So these are masculine and feminine stories that are at work here, and they're in your psyche. You recognized everything I said about that story, and I really didn't have to do much explaining because the archetype is so powerful. Okay, so here's a I want to now go on an even more simple level here. What do I mean by masculine and feminine? And I want to talk about kind of the archetypal qualities of them. The masculine is much more about how things work, how to do something. Okay? The feminine is much more interested in what is it, or the what of something. Or, let me put it another way, what's important? And the masculine might say, how does it work? And the feminine would say, what's the point? Do you feel how the tension starts to arise here? Now, which is better? Well, okay. Here's another way of putting it. The masculine tends to be archetypal pattern over time, aim, action, forward moving. Feminine, more receptivity, meaning, and relational. I'm not saying men and women. Do you hear I'm saying masculine and feminine here? Okay. And I'll just go ahead and put it as directly as I can. Masculine and feminine do not directly correspond to gender. Okay? They don't. It doesn't mean that they're not in conversation, but they don't directly correlate. It's much more like the pattern transcends gender in some way. It's that powerful of a reality. Okay, so here's an image of wholeness. So this comes from, oh man, I knew I was going to do this. I have a lot to say today. I'm just going to keep going until I'm done. So get ready. I think, over here till next week. All right, so just a little bit from Jung here. So Jung said that the psyche itself, I'll just be a little short, is both masculine and feminine. Okay, every single person on the planet has both masculine and feminine qualities in their psyche. If you don't even like the word psyche, in their brains. And that feels right to us. And you can have a dominant disposition that isn't associated with your gender. Okay? So you can be a male and have a more feminine disposition. Feminine archetypal qualities can be your primary orientation, or it can go the other way around. Make sense? Now, one of the things that Jung said that was so powerful is that, but maturity looks like what he called the hieros gamos, which means sacred marriage. That inside your psyche, there's the possibility of a sacred marriage between the masculine and feminine. That means that sometimes you need to cultivate more masculine qualities. Sometimes it means you have to cultivate more feminine qualities. And the more you do so, the more whole you become. That's his image of wholeness, hieros gamos, the sacred internal marriage. And you've met people probably who feel more whole to you. And that would be hard to describe, but if we were involved in the conversation, we said, well, what makes them more whole? Probably some balance of qualities is at work here. They have access to both worlds. They're not so one-sided. Make sense? And guess what? They're more enjoyable people to hang out with in general. So he's saying something like, all right, not only are masculine and feminine real, though archetypal and often hard to find, realities, you carry both inside. Everybody does. And a culture that loses sight of that doesn't know how to interact with young people. How do we cultivate these qualities? Is it okay to have the certain qualities that you have and be a certain gender? Or is it not okay? Do you feel how we start to get into those culture war issues? But if you don't understand that the psyche contains both, then it's a much more challenging world and a much more myopic world, and I don't think one that helps people out very much. Now, here's the surprising sort of move. In the model that I'm describing, differences matter, not sameness. Differences matter. It's in the elevation of the differences that all the dynamics happen. You know, like opposites attract. Why do people say that? They say because it's true. That's why they say it. And it's in the fiery poles that some kind of third is generated. It's not in the flattening out. And this goes back to what I'm saying. If we treat the masculine and feminine as sacred realities that need to be cultivated, then we actually have to talk about differences. And in the elevation of the differences, that's where all the fun is. All right? Have I made sense? Kind of theoretically? Okay. Let me put it in more direct terms here. An egalitarian future might depend on differences and not sameness. It's that, do you feel the irony there? I'm for a more egalitarian future. Are you? Well, part of that is going to come from the elevation of the poles and in the conversation that happens between, not by ignoring. That's sort of my intuition here. And one more thing, I'll just pick on Christianity for a second. So one of the things that Jung said, I put the quote down because it's so funny. He said, one of the problems with Christianity is that there is no feminine representative in the upper parliament. Now, because it's out of balance in some way. It's out of balance. Now, it's correcting itself to a certain extent. That's why Mary is so important for Christianity. You know, you try to push Mary down, but you can't. You know, why? Because the feminine is repressed. And same in Judaism, you have the Shekhinah, or the Shekinah. The Shekhinah is how you say it. But that's the feminine expression of Yahweh, of God. And that just came up right out of the heart of Judaism, because you can't have a worldview that just contains one element of masculine or feminine. You could take either extreme. Have I made sense? Okay. Okay, now I'll just try to close it here. Here are questions that I think are worth carrying. First of all, statement, it's a sacred task to carry the masculine and the feminine. That's what I would say. It's a sacred task to cultivate and carry the masculine and feminine. It's a sacred task to tell stories that have to do with the masculine and feminine. It's sacred. It's important. It's really, really, really important in my view. Here's another question. Where can we look to honor the feminine? Where can we look to honor the masculine? Right now, the easiest thing in the world to do is to tear everything down to nothing. I think the harder question is to say, where can we honor it? Do you know any examples of the sacred feminine? Do you know any examples of the sacred masculine? I was kind of moved by the death of the queen, largely because it drags up all the archetypal stuff. Really? I mean, you know, I'm not saying we should go back to a monarchy, all right? But I'm saying it's dragging it all up. What are our images? What do we think is important culturally? Where can we look to honor the masculine or the feminine? So I challenge you in that respect. And here's my final point. And this is more personal, but how am I in conversation with my own masculine and feminine qualities? You know, how's that? How's that for a lunchtime conversation? All right. How in touch am I with them? And often I find with men something ironic. You think what needs to happen with men is that they need to cultivate their feminine side. And that is true. But the masculine has been so neglected that it tends to be the other way around first. They're so out of contact with what is potentially good and true and beautiful with the masculine that they can't get anywhere near the feminine in the first place. It's just a little something I'm observing. Of course, that's not true for me, only others. Okay. I think maybe a final image. When we turn some attention toward the poles here, that the opposite starts humming like a tuning fork. And then we have something like a song in the world that's important. That's what I got for you. Thanks.